Welcome. You're listening to the Mac Observer's Background Mode. This is your host, John Martellaro. And this week, my guest is Canopy Studios WordPress developer, Julie Cool.
Hello. How are you, John?
I am good. How are you?
I am awesome.
It's so great to have you on the show. You know, we've worked together at the Mac Observer. We've done some stuff together. And we did some transcribing together some years back. And I got to know you. You are the world's best transcriber, by the way.
That was awesome. A fun project, no doubt.
That was. We used this crazy cool tool called Scrivener Transcription Tool that allows you to play the audio in one window, in one pane, and then listen to it and get good control over it, and then transcribe it in another window.
I have done other transcriptions without Scrivener, and oh my gosh, what an improvement.
It's surprising that there's no better tool yet.
Yeah, no, it's an awesome way to use it.
Yeah, yeah. So you wrote for the Mac Observer. You were telling me before the show, was it 5 years ago you
started? It was about 5 years ago. I'm not writing for them currently, but I did some news stories. I still remember I was helping out the day that Steve Jobs died. And so that was actually shortly after I started. So that was an interesting time to be helping out the crew.
I really liked your writing at the Mac Observer. I wish you were still working for us.
Oh, yeah, time. If only there were time to do everything.
And you do so many things, too.
I know.
You are a woman after my heart, if I may say so. Because you do all the cool things that I really admire and that I have done myself. You're into Macs. You're into WordPress. You've done martial arts, as have I. And you're into cars. That's amazing stuff, and you're very academic.
Yeah, I have kind of a strange background. It's not normal. Then again, most of the people I know, and probably most of your listeners, probably don't fall under the normal category either. So, you know, good for us. But yeah, I do have some far-reaching interests and hobbies and things that I've done. I mean, I've spanned the gamut to, at one time I was a president of sorority, to at one time I was teaching police officers martial arts in Japan, you know, so.
Oh, fabulous. Did you learn any Japanese?
I did. I could speak and read Japanese for a while. I remember the one time I was in Japan, what, two or three times, I think? And I remember one time I was there on a trade mission, actually. It was for work, and I went and connected with a professor in Japan, and I got to tour their version of a UPS facility, and the tour guide was giving the tour, and I was actually able to follow along. I was so stunned that I
wow.
could actually, you know, not need a translator for that. So
I always thought that was a rather difficult language, because it uses a different what do you call it, not alphabet, but different character
yeah.
set.
Yeah, they actually, you can call them whatever you want. It's essentially three alphabets, two of which only have, you know, a few letters. It's not 26, but it's in that range. I can't remember anymore. And then, of course, there's the kanji, which is numbers in the thousands, which I probably only ever knew a few hundred. So, yeah, that's a thing. And, oh, am I rusty. I would love to bone up on that again, to get back to the point where I was before.
So you have a black belt in karate.
I actually have several black belts, and one of these days I will find all my certificates and figure out exactly what they are. It was karate, it was sword.
What systems did you get a black belt in?
I was in Seitokan karate for the most part, and we touched on a variety of things. I mean, I know I studied, you know, judo and ninjutsu and kobudo, and I can't even remember all of them, but iaido sword was my favorite. Oh, I dream of sword work.
There's a technique. What is the name of that? Lucy Liu, the actress, is into swords.
Is
that a variation of kendo?
Yes, it is. Kendo would be basically practice swords. But it has developed into its own form of fencing, basically. Mm-hmm. So, like the actual metal swords that I used would not be appropriate for that matter. I got to tell this story since you've allowed me to.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
When I was in Japan, we were doing sword work at a dojo there, at a school there, and an elderly gentleman with a very traditional school. We had this, you know, we were the guests, and so his own students, there weren't enough swords to go around, weren't enough practice swords to go around, so he gave one of the live blades, the sharpened blades, to one of his students, who immediately proceeded to nearly cut his thumb off, you know, trying to resheath the sword. And as they were, you know, like applying pressure and trying to keep, you know, the wound from, you know, spurting all over the place, the teacher was saying
Sensei.
Something. Yes, well, Soke in this case, he was mm-hmm. he was like a 10th degree black belt. And so he was like, better you had cut your thumb off than damaged the sword or the scabbard, because your thumb will heal, the scabbard or the sword will not. And I'm like, whoa, okay. Yeah, that's an interesting way of looking.
Oh, can I tell you one of my stories?
Sure.
I was in a karate school. I studied Kenpo in New Mexico and then later in Denver here. And the head of the school arranged for a very senior friend who was in his 50s or 60s to come in and teach us a special class at a gymnasium that they rented. And he was teaching us all these advanced techniques. And he was showing us this technique about I don't want to get into technical details because I don't remember completely what was going on, but there was this maneuver that he was teaching us how to deal with, you know, a bent elbow and stressing somebody's elbow. And I got this bee in my bonnet. I was younger and stupid, and I just put my foot behind him and reversed, and he went down on his butt.
Yep.
And this was the worst thing that young John Marchalero could have ever done. And I had to apologize to him. I had to apologize to his boss. I had to apologize to the school instructor and beg that they didn't suspend me.
Oops.
Oops. But, you know, that's how I grew up, is, you know, as a young scientist, you know, I wonder what would happen if, you know, it got me into more trouble than I can tell you.
Oh, no kidding. It's called experimenting, you know.
Yeah.
It's the same thing as throwing Cheerios over the edge of your high chair, you know.
That's right.
That's how
right.
you discover gravity. So.
You told me before the show that you built a web server very early in your life.
Oh.
That appealed to me, too, because... I have my own story to tell you. You tell me your story, and I'll tell you mine.
Well, basically, I'm old, and one of the first jobs I had gotten, my boss came in and said, you know, there's this internet thing out there, and we ought to do something about it. We ought to know something about it. So I'm gonna buy like this computer thing, and you figure it out. So I got tasked with, you know, figuring out a PC, and shortly thereafter, you know, a few years after, the web came along, and then it's like, okay, we need a website. You figure it out. So I actually built my first website probably in 1994, and I can't remember. I was looking up some statistics recently that led me to believe I had one of the first 700 websites on the.
Back in, back in the days when we thought that maybe there might be a maximum of 1,000 for all time.
Back in the days when you needed an EDU email to get into Facebook. So, yeah, long time ago. So, yeah, so I actually did. I had an old computer, and I had a server under my desk in my office. And, yeah, I ran the web server from my little old office, you know.
Is this the NCSA web server, the first one? Years before Apache.
Yeah, I can't even remember how I ran it. There's some of that stuff, it just... As a matter of fact, it was interesting that I mentioned I'm currently a web developer, and... I have found that I have this complete reticence to the command line, because to me it feels like going back to, you know, like 1990 and having to do mm-hmm. everything with DOS prompt. So I'm getting over
Unix
that.
Unix prompt. Yeah, no, we don't speak DOS. We speak Unix. It's more highbrow.
This is true. It is Unix now. It was DOS back then. Anyway, so yeah, I'm getting over that though.
Well, my story is that I was at the Oak Ridge National Lab and I had a Unix mentor. He was a senior scientist who noticed that I was a Mac freak and had a Quadra in my office. And he said, John, you really need to get into some serious Unix because this is the Oak Ridge National Lab, you know, and those Macs are just toys. And they were. Before they were Unix, they were a toy operating system called Mac OS, which was abysmal. I mean, it didn't have reentrant code, it didn't have memory protection, and it was just terrible. And you know, so all of us Mac people in 1993 or four, we thought we were hot. But he introduced me to his DEC Alpha Digital Equipment Corporation running the RISC processor in the DEC Alpha. Boy, was it fast! It was probably 20 or 30 times faster than my Mac. And he introduced me to Mosaic. So we started, you know, carousing the web and looking at these sites and probably ran across yours. And we said, well, why don't we try running a web server? So we downloaded this NCSA web server from the National Center for Supercomputing in Illinois, I think. And we had this zip file. And so I'm sitting there with Charlie, and we really don't know what we're doing. And so we unzip it, and we run it. And it starts asking us these questions, and we don't understand the questions at all. It's asking for configuration stuff. And so we're sitting there, and he's driving, and I'm going, yeah, okay, I don't know what that means. Take the default. And we return, take the default, return. Right. So when we're all done, we have this web server running, and it's only internal because we haven't registered yet. And I go back to my office, and I hit the IP address, and I go, wow, this is so cool.
Right. No kidding.
Yeah.
Back
in the days.
Yeah, and websites, you know, marquee tags and blink tags were a thing, and, you know, under construction pages.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, God. Anyway, yeah.
When you grow up with it, you it's kind of fun to go back and see how primitive things were.
You know, it's interesting, too, because as a web developer, you know, we're concerned with accessibility of sites. And that I used to, you know, talk about it. I'd kind of get irritated when people would talk about accessibility because it always meant that you couldn't do the fun things that you wanted to do with, you know, Flash back in the day or whatever. But I've come full circle on that because to me, accessibility nowadays means anybody can access the site from any device, so that I can get it on my car dash, or I can get it on my refrigerator, or I can get it, you know, on my phone when I only have one hand available because the other hand is tied up with, I don't know, groceries or, you know, whatever, broken arm, whatever. So accessibility is, you know, kind of back on my radar. But back in those days, everything was accessible because everything was essentially strictly HTML and then little or no CSS, and certainly not like JavaScript and Flash and all those other things that are out there that makes it more difficult for all the various devices that are, you know, accessing websites these days. So, yeah, we're kind of coming full circle trying to simplify things again.
Yeah, yeah. I was reading an article the other day about, I think it was Jean-Louis Gasset's Monday Note this week, where he was talking about it takes 55 pages of code to produce one page of text.
Sounds about right. That sounds about right. Yeah, the fact that you basically need to know six languages to write one, you know, web page is kind of crazy sometimes. Yeah. Anyway, and that's a simple one.
Well, I'll tell you what. Why don't we take a break? And I've got a little short commercial here to play. And then when we come back, we'll talk about cars and motorcycles and sci-fi. How's that sound?
Perfect.
All right, folks. We'll be right back in 60 seconds. Stay with us.
Hello there, all you fabulous background mode listeners. I'm Kelly Gamont with the Mac Observer, and I just want to say a few words about how you can support all the things we do. If you're thinking about buying something from Apple, Amazon, or Mac Mall, just go to the Mac Observer's homepage where we have a section called Support TMO. Or you can just enter macobserver.com/Apple Store, all one word, and that will take you to our special page for Apple and our other affiliates. If you make a purchase from one of our partners this way, the Mac Observer receives a small compensation for sending business their direction. Pretty cool, right? And you don't pay a penny more. This small fee from our affiliates helps us continue to bring you TMO's daily news, reviews, tips, how-tos, and podcasts like this one. So the next time you're thinking about an online purchase, come to TMO's homepage and support the Mac Observer. Thanks. Back to you, John.
We're back. Thanks, Kelly. I'm talking to Julie Cool. You are a WordPress expert.
I don't like the word expert.
Is that because WordPress is so monstrous and complicated and tricky?
It's because the minute somebody says they're an expert, usually it means they don't really know much of anything. It's kind of just it's maybe inside baseball, but you know, there's a lot of people out there that don't really know what they're doing, that you know, sell themselves as WordPress experts. Mm-hmm. And it's just kind of one of those things now that raises the hairs on the back of my neck.
All right, take it back. So listeners, just skip the last 30 seconds.
I'm an experienced
Hey Julie,
WordPress
you are a WordPress enthusiast.
I've actually got a site called a domain name called WP Bingo, and one of these days I'm going to put it together for a blackout sheet of all the things you need to do before you become this experienced WordPress developer. Mm-hmm. Like, oh, I don't know, break somebody's site or take down their email or, you know, forget a semicolon that blows up everything and, you know, all the things that everybody winds up doing sooner or later because that's just the way it goes. So,
speaking of missing semicolons, I was mentioning before the Oak Ridge National Lab. After my Unix mentor convinced me that I needed a better machine, I got an SGI Indy, the beautiful blue silicon graphics machine. And it didn't have a very big hard disk, so I wanted to move a major section of the operating system to an external drive. And I sat down with another fellow who was a Perl expert and a Unix expert, and we wrote this long Perl string to transfer a major portion of the operating system out to this external drive. And we looked at it, and we said, is that right? That's right. And we looked at it, like we checked it like 6 times, but we forgot a dot.
Yeah.
There was one dot that we forgot in Perl. And so I run this Perl script, and it's churning along, and what it's doing is it's gobbling up the operating system, but it's not writing it to the disk. And in a moment, I see this indicator on the display. It says, kernel panic.
Yep. Yep.
Oh, yeah, those dots and semicolons will get you.
Yeah, and sometimes you just can't spot them. You need somebody else to come along and look at it and go, oh, yeah, you forgot it over here. It's like,
yeah, there were two of us, and we both missed it. Yeah. How did you get into WordPress? I mean, how did you get all started in all that?
You know, I really wish I could remember exactly. I had always been, you know, the nerd in the office, and you know, so I had the website, I had the server as well, you know, and I eventually that got to be a big enough job that I couldn't do it anymore, and it got handed off to somebody else. But I was always kind of the tech person in the office. So I had, you know, some experience with using WordPress, you know, having to put content up on websites. And I was looking to change careers and decided I wanted to do programming of some sort. And I didn't know, did I want to learn, you know, iOS programming or Mac programming or what? And I really don't remember how I glommed onto WordPress, but I do remember that I went to one of their events called a WordCamp, and I was totally hooked at that point. That was back in January of 2013, and just one experience at a WordCamp just I took off.
That's what seduced you away from the Mac Observer. Now I know.
Yeah, yeah, and those were the two big things. It was, you know, Macworld and WordCamp. So yeah, that's the traveling.
Hmm. So you build websites for Canopy in San Francisco,
mm-hmm.
and so you get these assignments, right? So-and-so client, here's the guy or here's the woman, and then what happens? Do you have to kind of like do a Skype session with them and sort of get a feel for how they want it designed and all that? How does that go?
Yeah, I actually had been doing freelancing, and I've just recently joined Canopy Studios, so now that I'm at Canopy Studios, I don't do all of the things I just do one of the things that's required to make a website. But yeah, you normally, you know, somebody says I need some work done on an existing website, or I need a brand new website, or I need a website that needs to be just completely rebuilt, so we might as well just start from scratch. Mm. And yeah, you have to figure out exactly what they're trying to do, the kind of budget they've got, who's going to maintain it, how much information they're going to put out there. You know, how
is it what if it's one of those sites where it's constantly changing and being updated? Do they send you files and then you have to update it, or do you teach them how to do it?
Usually, I try to teach them how to do it. There are some things that, you know, depending on the client, you know, mm-hmm. some are okay with doing things themselves, and others just don't even want to be bothered. I mean, even if they could do it, they don't want to. They have other things to do. So, you know, that's just something that you negotiate and put together on a client-by-client basis. And, you know, everybody has their own boundaries. Every, you know, developer out there, every agency out there sets their own limits as far as what they will and won't do. But there is a market for all of those things where, you know, people are completely hands-off and they want you to build everything for them. Mm-hmm. Or other people that are really hands-on and just got in over their head and just need a couple of hours, or sometimes even just a hint as far as, you know, what they need to do to improve their site or change it and make it do what they want it to do.
I remember I used to run a website out of a home office I had in the early days when you could get a static IP address.
Yeah.
And I was running Red Hat something like 3.3, and there was this known problem in Red Hat 3.3 or something like that I didn't know about. And one day I'm looking at my machine and I'm going, this looks suspicious. And I then munch around a little bit and see, I've been hacked.
Hacked.
Yeah. So I erased the drive and reinstalled the newest version of Linux. And pretty soon of Red Hat. And pretty soon my days of running a home web server on a static IP address were over, because I was keeping a log. I had written a Perl script to email me the intrusion attempts.
Yeah.
And there was something like one a second. For 86,400 seconds in a day, there was about one intrusion attempt per second. I thought, this is a losing game. I'm not doing this anymore.
So. Yep, I actually just turned off those notifications last weekend. I had a site that was, there are managed hosting companies and then just general cheap, you know, shared hosting companies out there for websites, whether they're WordPress, Drupal, Joomla, whatever you want to do. And one of the things the managed sites do is manage that type of security for
mm-hmm.
you.
Yeah.
And sure, they cost more, but I tell you what, between not having to get all those notifications about brute force attacks and also having, you know, backups that I'm confident of and that I'm basically not responsible for either, is worth the money. So I'm a real big fan of managed hosting for websites, especially for people who don't know what they're doing. If you don't know what you're doing, you ought not to be going with cheap stuff.
Let the big guys fight off the attackers
and
hackers. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, how about we finish the tech talk? Because I want to talk about cars.
Okay, good.
Cars and motorcycles.
Cool.
The reason, I don't know if I mentioned this earlier in the show, but one of the other reasons, one of the 17 zillion different reasons why you're someone who's after my heart is because you're into Mustangs.
I am.
And my first car was a Mach 1.
Oh,
with the black anti-glare hood and the clips and the Cleveland 351 V8. And the wide oval tires, four on the floor.
What year?
69.
Oh.
Maroon.
Oh.
Deep burgundy maroon color.
That's pretty close to the dream machine. Yep, yep, yep.
Yeah. And I just almost killed myself twice in that car. As a young person tends to do when you get your hands on a car like that with 350 foot-pounds of torque and 240 horsepower and a giant V8. And it's amazing I'm still alive today.
Well, those are the things that if you survive, you have some real good stories to tell when you get older. So, you know, what doesn't kill you makes you stronger and more interesting. How's that?
That's right. I don't know. So you had an affection for that car too, huh?
Yeah, I have to admit, I am a big fan of the original, the 65 Mustang. There's just something about that look. But I'm developing a real soft spot for like the 68s with the fastbacks. And I currently own a 2005 Mustang, which has kind of got that retro look to it.
They resurrected the original Mach 1 design two years ago.
Yeah, there's a new generation of Mustangs out, too, that I really like. I do like them.
You know what I don't like about the new Mustangs, though? They have that Mustang emblem in the middle of the rear bumper under the hood, but it's not the real filler cap.
Oh,
it's got the silly door on the side. And there must be some federal regulation that you can't run the filler cap down through the trunk anymore.
Probably.
But mine had this giant, like, 5-pound metal clip in the back, and you'd press a button and open it up, and you'd fill it up right in the middle of the back of above the bumper.
You can buy those.
Yeah.
Aftermarket is a hot thing for Mustangs, let me tell you.
There is a neighbor who lives just down the street from me who has one of those 68 Mustang convertibles. It's red. And my wife and I were out walking as he was backing out of the driveway one day, and I said, "You know, I take it easy." And he says, "Yeah, I know, it's a death trap. It has no headrests. It has no airbags. It has no side intrusion bars. It has a metal steering wheel."
if you drive it over
30, you die.
Yeah, I have to admit, as much as I admire a 65 Mustang, I don't know if I ever want to own one.
Yeah.
It's partly, like you say, from a safety standpoint, it's not something I'd be driving anywhere on a regular basis. And secondly, I love them so much that I don't want to be responsible for it. I think they need to be preserved for future generations, and, you know, like, they have to be stored and maintained and kept up. And I just don't know if I have the resources and time or money to do that as I would expect someone who owns those to do. So anyway, I have a 2005 that's on the low end of the
line. What color
is it? It's screaming yellow.
Oh, yellow. Lamborghini yellow?
Yeah. I do like the yellow ones. I do have a soft spot for the yellow Mustangs. This one is not it's not going to be a survivor. It's already been beat up pretty bad, so I'm not feeling too bad if I beat it up a little bit more.
Another one of my fantasy cars is the 1963 Corvette Stingray.
Oh, those are nice.
The Route 66 Todd Stiles Buzz Murdoch Stingray. I grew up watching Route 66. I have an affection for that car, too. I had a chance to buy one. I was at a car show in Knoxville years ago, and this guy had one for sale. It was like $33,000.
Yeah.
And I
they're
thought,
up there.
I can't afford that, but I would love to have one of these.
I'm always amazed at the price they have on some of those older cars, and the fact that it's a really hot market. I mean, the fact that it's like at $35,000, $40,000, $50,000, $60,000, $70,000. Over $100,000, people are still out there buying them. I'm like, okay. Good on you guys.
Have you seen Jay Leno's garage where that guy does appraisals?
Yeah. And some of them, I mean, I totally understand why they have that value. I mean, I totally get it. They're rare. They're getting rarer. So, yeah, they're a thing.
In 1975, when I sold that car, nobody wanted a Mustang that had, 75,000 miles on it. But now, lots of people want one.
It's only got 75,000 miles.
Okay. Well, in the time we have left, I want to talk to you about science fiction. So you do a sci-fi podcast called Sci-Fi Tech Talk.
Yep. We have been negligent.
Why haven't I been on the show?
That's a good question. Mostly because we're really bad at planning. We just never seem to coordinate schedules enough. I have myself and two co-hosts, and it seems like it's all we can do to get the three of us together, much less schedule guests.
Who are your hosts?
There's a gentleman called Jeff Sire, who's out of Canada, and another gentleman out of South Dakota called Mike McPeak. So we have all three been in one place at the same time. And so that was kind of fun. It was a unique opportunity that we decided we couldn't pass up. But most of the time, we just knew each other through Twitter or through other online communities, one of which is the Mac community. So, yeah, it's been interesting to get to know them. And yeah,
do you invite guests on the show?
We do from time to time. We've had Brian Chafin on because he's a...
he's written a novel.
Budding, yeah, novel. Yeah.
I had David Brin on Background Mode a few months ago.
One of my favorites.
He was awesome. You should get him on the show. I'm sure he'd be delighted. We talked about extraterrestrials, and we talked about the evolution of extraterrestrial life and the probability of encounters, given maybe, you know, a million-year head start a civilization might have.
That would be interesting. I have had some Twitter conversations with him, so that's a possibility. I guess we've chatted with... Have we had him on the show? I don't think we've had him on the show. J.C. Hutchins? He's out of Denver, isn't he? Or did he move?
I don't know.
And then another guy, J.F. Dubow, who's also a kind of a budding sci-fi writer. He won a sword and laser contest and had his first sci-fi novel actually printed, and now he's working on a second and third and a couple other things. So yeah, he's kind of taken off. And
you know who I'd go after if I could get him? He's too big now, but if I could get him, I'd go after Andy Weir.
You know, I've heard he's done some podcasts. Who had him on that I was like, really? He talked to somebody I know. Had him
I bet he's a really nice guy, and he'd be delighted to be on anybody's show.
Yeah, and that's, you know, boy, that's one of my favorite ones, recent sci-fi properties. The Martian was just a fabulous book and a fabulous movie. And
when I first read that book, the first page or two, I thought to myself, this is the best opening page of any sci-fi novel I have ever read. And the reason is we can't say the word because this is a G-rated family show. But it's amazing how quickly he gets himself into trouble and realizes what kind of trouble he's in and communicates that to the reader, and it's just amazing.
Yeah, we just had this discussion yesterday with I think it was the coworkers, as far as whether the movie or the book was better, and I kind of like both, actually, for different reasons. I think the book, I read the book first and had real curiosity, I guess. I was going to say concerns, but that wasn't it. It was more curiosity how they were going to portray that in a movie, because much of the book was inside his head. It was, you know, there's nobody around. He's just thinking. Mm-hmm. He's not talking to anybody. I'm like, oh, great, we're going to have a silent film, right? But they did well with the movie. But I think because of those internal discussions, I think the book adds something. So if you've only seen the movie, I encourage you to read the book. But yeah, I really like that one because there are a couple mulligans in there science-wise, but it is a lot of hard science. A lot of it is.
But he makes it so approachable, and he makes you feel like, wow, I want to be a NASA scientist. I want to know all this stuff.
And he makes it, he teaches you.
Yes.
Yeah, he teaches you. It's like, okay, we need this. How are we going to do this? Well, we have this. The formula is this. Let's see what we can do. You know, and yeah, I mean, it's very hard science fiction, as opposed to soft science fiction or science fantasy. But yeah, it did it in such a really neat way that I felt that was one of the few books when I got done with it that I'm like, I learned a lot about science by reading this book. And without it being a textbook.
Have you heard of The Arrival? The trailer just came out. It's not The Arrival, it's just Arrival.
No.
It's from Paramount, and it's going to be out in November, and I just saw the trailer. And what happens is these extraterrestrials arrive, but it's apparently very cerebral. And Amy Adams, one of my favorite actresses, is a PhD linguist, and the Department of Defense grabs her and says, we've got extraterrestrials, and we don't know how to talk to them, and they don't know how to talk to us. We need you. And so she starts learning how to communicate with these extraterrestrials. And I guess the goal, from what I read, is to figure out what they want, why they're here, and whether they're a threat. And you know, they're not attacking. They're not blowing things up or anything. They just arrive, and they want to communicate.
That's interesting. Have you seen Contact, Jodie Foster?
Oh, it's one of my favorite movies of all time. I have a DVD of that.
That rings a bell with some of the things that were going on in that movie, too. So, yeah, some good stuff there. Good stuff.
Have you seen Interstellar?
Oh, yeah, yeah. Uh-huh. That's on the short list of really good ones lately.
Well, you know what I think's happened is ever since, what was it? The Martian has sort of launched this theme of really smart, heads-up, technical science fiction movies. And we have, you know, there was stuff in the past that was kind of silly, like, you know, Independence Day, which I thought was kind of silly, you know. Power Book 140, you know, inserts a virus into an extraterrestrial interstellar spaceship. Yeah, right. But movies like Ex Machina and Interstellar and The Martian and this thing, The Arrival, it looks like it's a new generation of very technical, cerebral, but and yet compelling and exciting sci-fi movies, and I'm really glad to see that.
Have you seen Europa Report?
I tried.
Really?
It bored me to tears.
Are you kidding?
I watched the first 15 minutes and I thought, all right, some other time.
I had just the opposite with that one. We were going to do it for the podcast. Somebody suggested it, and like, okay, fine. And I just kind of put it on, and I was going to do some other things. Mm-hmm. And I found myself sitting on the edge of the couch going, what? Because it's done kind of in a documentary
kind of a 2001 Space Odyssey kind of abstract, low-key.
Yeah, and it was, I found it, as a matter of fact, in our podcast, everybody who listens to our podcast knows I have my two extremes of movies that we've watched. The one I like the best, kind of the gold standard, and the one that, you know, I use for a swear word on occasion. But yeah, to me, Europa Report is that gold standard because it was so low key. There was no buzz about it. And it was enough hard science to be good, enough fiction in there to, you know, get you thinking a little bit. On the flip side, the movie that I hate the most, and I will rant for hours if you allow me to, is Starship Troopers. I like the book.
Yeah.
I hate the movie.
Oh, yeah. Robert Heinlein. Starship Troopers was awesome. I grew up on Heinlein, Asimov, Clark, Sturgeon, Zelezny.
Yeah.
Yeah. Starship Troopers was a little shaky. Yeah. And there was an even worse sequel.
Yeah, the fact that they make a sequel, you know, just proves that there's no hope for the human species, I think. I don't know, but it's just that movie. Anyway, I could go on. I won't.
Well, you know, we can't because we're running out of time quickly here. This is going a lot faster than I thought it would. This has been fun.
Yeah.
So we'll have to do this again sometime.
Yeah, no doubt. We could go on for hours, I'm afraid. So,
I'm afraid.
Let's not do that because, you know, we have listeners. So,
want the listeners wanting more.
That's it.
Yeah. So, I guess we ought to wrap it up. This has been wonderful. Thanks for being on the show.
Yeah, thanks for inviting me.
I enjoyed it. So, I'm looking forward to being on yours.
Will happen.
We can carry on the discussion.
All right. It will happen.
And listeners, I appreciate you coming by. I hope you had fun listening to Julie and me reminisce and talk geek. And we'll see you next time on the Mac Observer's Background Mode.